Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, May 11, 2016. The UN says thousands of South Sudanese internally displaced persons are returning home.
I just reported that now we are just at about 180,000. Some have gone back to their areas. Some have settled in other areas where they feel comfortable. Some have left the country.
And South Sudanese diaspora say threats by Kenya to close Kakuma refugee camp will affect South Sudanese refugees.
To hear about Kakuma being closed is kind of shocking, and I don't think it would be wise for the Kenyan government to do that. A lot of those South Sudanese and even many other refugees from different countries have no homes inside, you know, Kakuma.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A UN official in South Sudan says more than 20,000 internally displaced persons sheltering in UN-run camps across the country have voluntarily returned home over the last 3 months. IDPs say the improved security situation in the country and the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity is convincing many families to return to their homes and villages. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Officer in charge of the Relief, Reintegration and Protection Unit at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan told the journalists at a briefing in Juba today that thousands of IDPs have been voluntarily leaving the UN protection of civilians' sites and returning to their homes because aid agencies are providing more humanitarian services. Sam Mohumure says the number of IDPs at the various camps are reducing.
At some point, we had about 200,000 people in the POC sites. And I just reported that now we are just at about 180,000. Some have gone back to their areas. Some have settled in other areas where they feel comfortable. Some have left the country.
Mohumure says since fighting between the two main warring parties in South Sudan's conflict subsided in recent months, aid agencies have been able to lend support to people affected by the conflict. He says IDPs are now encouraged to voluntarily return to their former residences. He says only about 10% of the more than 200,000 IDPs being hosted in UN camps have voluntarily left. Some IDPs say they will not leave the camp because they still feel it's too dangerous. 37-year-old Deng Diang Chuol and his family took refuge at the UNMISS camp in Juba on December 17, 2013, 2 days after fighting between government and rebel forces broke out. He says IDPs at the site in Juba are too afraid to return home.
If this thing happened in Malkal and Bentiu, but here in Juba POC, this thing does not happen because we are still in the POC, because we are fearing for our security outside. Yeah, we cannot go outside because all our houses have been occupied by some of the individuals. Yeah, since we left the town.
32-year-old Binitut has lived in the UN camp in Juba with his family since December 2013. He says he doesn't feel safe either.
We are still in a UNMISS camp because our home has been occupied by our enemy or our brother. So now, when you go outside, it is very easy for the people to fight because somebody occupy your home. How can you go there now?
According to statistics from the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, since January of this year, only 40 IDPs have voluntarily left the protection of civilians camp in Juba. The IDPs say they want to first receive assurances that people who have been occupying their houses have moved out before they return. IDPs also say they want to see concrete steps taken by the Transitional Government of National Unity to ensure they will be safe when they leave the camps. Mohumure says the Transitional Government of National Unity should come up with a clear agenda which addresses the resettlement of the IDPs, including how basic services will be provided in areas hardest hit by the conflict.
They don't only need to hear that the transitional government has been formed? No. But also, what is the program and the agenda for the transitional government? There are certain things, support areas that they will need. First and primarily, safety and security in the areas where they are going to. There will be need for the transitional government, together with the international community and the development and humanitarian partners, to collectively support the establishment of basic services in some of these areas.
Information Minister Michael Makuei said last week the cabinet discussed the resettlement of the IDPs and told everyone occupying houses belonging to the IDPs to vacate the premises now.
All those who are occupying houses of others illegally should move out of those houses immediately. In lieu of that, the security organs are authorized to take action against anybody who does not want to move out immediately.
Makuei says the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs will oversee the repatriation of the IDPs at the UN camps to their various destinations. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Meanwhile, in the new Yei River State, an official with the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission says heavy rains have flooded shelters of thousands of internally displaced persons. As VOA fellow Tito Justin reports from Yei, South Sudan has been experiencing heavy rains for the past 2 weeks.
This is a rain season in South Sudan, and farmers are preparing their fields to plant various crops. The heavy rain is not a good news to the IDPs who are living under temporary shelters. Most of the internal displaced persons at the camp in Yei are women and children who escaped violence in the former Western Equatorial State last year. Many walked for hundreds of kilometers to reach Yei River State. Arcangelo Sebit is the chairperson of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Yei. Sebit says South Sudan needs financial support to cater for the IDPs. He says the IDPs are in dire need of basic life-saving items.
So it has been very difficult to manage them through livelihood because food is not regular. Two, there has not been any service of health, and they are actually now just being by themselves, going to look for peace work, and then they get little money. They pay the cost sharing in the civil hospital, in the clinics. It is really a very great challenge.
Ezekiel Justin is the chairman of the IDPs in Yei. Justin says the food they receive is not enough.
The issue of the food is that it doesn't come in time. The food comes after months, 2 or 3 months. There are carpets brought for us, but they are not enough. We only put them on the roof of our buildings, but some parts of the building remain without carpet. If it rains, our buildings inside are always covered with water.
Children in the IDP camp have not been enrolled into schools because most parents cannot afford the tuition fees. 30-year-old Charles Justin has 5 children, but none of them has been enrolled in school. Charity says she works to make sure that her children have food to eat. She says she could cultivate enough food for her family if given enough land. Speaking in Juba, Arabic Charity says, we ran up and down to look for money to buy and change our food with greens. She says, now as rain has started, we have planted greens all in our camp. Charity says, we are hard-working people. If the government gives us land, we can be able to cultivate and push life with it. Sebit says his office is expecting the IDPs to return home. He says plans are underway to identify those who feel it is safe to return home.
Now we are having the newly government of national unity formed, so we expect something which may be fruitful to us. Organize and try to, you know, to help them, because without the help of the international NGOs, they will never be sustained, and then they will always have that problem of, you know, suffering.
The IDPs say they will return to their homes if they are assured of the security in the former Western Equatorial State. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Yei.
Members of the South Sudanese diaspora in the United States are voicing their concerns over Kenya's announcement that it plans to close refugee camps in the country, including the large Kakuma refugee camp. Two former Lost Boys of South Sudan, who once called Kakuma home, say closing the camp would do more harm than good. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
If Kenya shuts down the camps, it could displace more than 600,000 refugees and limit options for refugee seekers in surrounding countries like Somalia and South Sudan. Jacob Atim is a former Lost Boy living in the southern U.S. state of Florida and is a past resident of Kakuma. He says the thought of closing down Kakuma is a dangerous one.
As a former refugee, I just don't know what I would have done if in 1992, when we arrived in Kakuma and the Kenya government said we wouldn't be allowed to come into Kenya as refugee. It's really a huge disaster.
Many refugees like Atim, who spent their teenage years in the camp, know that places like Kakuma are not a long-term solution. But for scores of refugees, it is the only option. The UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, says there are almost 56,000 South Sudanese refugees in Kenya, most of whom live at the Kakuma refugee camp. That includes about 10,000 refugees who arrived after South Sudan's conflict began in late 2013. Teresa Ongaro, a spokesperson for UNHCR in Nairobi, says the threat of closing down camps in Kenya would add to the already dire global migrant and refugee crisis. UNHCR says some 60 million people are forcibly displaced all over the world. Ongaro says it is important, now more than ever before, that international asylum obligations prevail.
The refugee phenomenon is common to African nations, and it places the burden, if I could call it that, on neighboring nations, because that's where people, that's the only place people, or the first place of refuge that people can run to when their country is at war. Having been a prominent advocate for robust international protection in Kenya, that it is troubling that Kenya should take this decision.
James Deng is a former Lost Boy and resident of Philadelphia, a city in the state of Pennsylvania on the east coast of the United States. Equipped with a degree in finance, Deng enjoys his work in Philadelphia, but says he is concerned for the thousands of people who are still struggling to survive in East Africa.
To hear about Kakuma being closed would be, you know, it's kind of shocking. And I don't think it would be wise for the Kenyan government to do that, because a lot of those South Sudanese and even many other refugees from different countries have no homes besides, you know, Kakuma.
Ongaro says the Kenyan government should follow its own laws on refugees and hold to its commitment to protect all refugees that enter their country.
Kenya has ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention and its corresponding protocols. And we also recognize that Kenya has played an extraordinary role over many years as one of the world's frontline major refugee hosting nations, along with other countries.
Ongaro says UNHCR has a tripartite agreement with the governments of Somalia and Kenya. The agreement determines how refugees move from one place to another and how they are informed by authorities about information that could impact their voluntary decision to return home. Ongaro says part of the issue is that the Kenyan government believes the current tripartite agreement between Somalia and UNHCR moves too slowly. Ongaro says a similar agreement does not exist for South Sudanese refugees. She says the situation in South Sudan does not lend itself to the safe return of refugees. It is unknown when Kenya will begin to close the camps or how long the process will take, but a statement issued last week by Kenya's Ministry of Interior said the government had disbanded its Department of Refugee Affairs and was working on a mechanism for the closure of Kenya's refugee camps. This is not the first time that Kenya has made such an announcement. Kenya says it needs to close the camps because of security concerns highlighted by the threat of terrorist groups known to be operating in the region. For VOA News, I'm Ayen Bior in Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, at least five internally displaced persons in northern Darfur are killed by unknown gunmen. We'll have reaction to that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you trust the news from your government media outlets?
Not really.
I don't trust the government news because they are favoring the side of the government only. They are not favoring all the right of the citizen within the country where they are in.
In radio station or television station, sometimes they exaggerate things just because they fear the government. They will just give them the information and they come, they add something on which is not the assured one. So for me, according to me, I don't really truly trust about the news in the media.
I trust some of them because some of them, they're not really accurate. And if you look mostly, maybe you look at different kinds of newspapers, you find that there's different information.
It's just halfway. Partly I do trust and then partly I don't trust. They don't give the news completely.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. The Office of the United Nations, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, and the UN Peacekeeping Mission in Darfur are condemning the killing of at least 5 internally displaced persons by local armed tribesmen in Sertoni in northern Darfur. The gunmen attacked an IDP site in Sertoni and a nearby marketplace on Monday evening. Nabil Biajo has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Both OCHA and UNAMID issued statements in Khartoum yesterday condemning the attacks. Samantha Newport is the UN OCHA spokesperson.
The killing of the 6 civilians and the injuring of an unconfirmed number of other individuals, including one of the peacekeepers themselves, took place after a rise in tensions between the displaced people and armed tribesmen who were in the area over alleged cattle raiding.
Newport says the IDPs in Sertoni fled recent fighting between government troops and rebels loyal to Abdul Wahid in Jabal Marra. She says most IDPs in the camp in Sertoni and other camps in Darfur are still vulnerable to attacks by gunmen and government-allied militias in Darfur. Newport says children were among the victims.
The situation had been escalating for a few days, and the culmination was this: these two incidents. Actually, there were two separate incidents that took place yesterday when the 6 people were killed, including these two children.
UNAMID spokesperson Ashraf Issa says tensions between cattle herders and IDPs have been brewing for more than a week, despite mediation efforts to defuse them.
The background to this is that there, since the 2nd of May, there has been some tensions in the area where some nomadic herders accused the IDPs of stealing some of their cattle and demanded the return of these cattle, but then things escalated and unfortunately this attack happened.
Issa says two suspected attackers were apprehended by UNAMID forces. He says UNAMID will hand over the suspects to local authorities in Kapkabiya in North Darfur.
The mission, through its civil affairs section, engaged with the relevant authorities and the parties, the IDPs and the nomads, in trying to resolve the issue, and also the native administration that plays an important role in resolving such misunderstandings. Meanwhile, of course, the mission calls both sides to exercise maximum restraint.
Most of the people injured in the attacks are receiving treatment at the UNAMID clinic in Sertoni. Issa says the mission is still verifying the exact number of people affected by the attacks. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biajo.
Still in Darfur, the Nubia Project, the Nubian Project, a cultural group working to preserve Sudan's historical sites, is rejecting a project by the Sudan government to build dams along the River Nile in Dal and Kajbar and Al-Sherik areas in Sudan. Many people in those areas say the dams will destroy important historical and ecological aspects of the land along the river. The Sudan government insists the construction of the dams will not destroy the country's historical sites. Nuruddin Manan, president and founder of the Nubia Project, says the government of Sudan intends to destroy the Nubian way of life by knocking down historical sites for miles, beginning north of Khartoum all the way to the border with Egypt. Manan says the proposed dam sites include extremely fertile soil, which is used for agricultural activities and has been home to hundreds, if not thousands, of important antiquities.
So Nubia Project is actually spearheading or leading these
campaigns to stop destroying Nubia and its antiquities and archaeological sites, which are considered the biggest archaeological sites in the world, according to the British historian Basil Davidson.
Manahani says his organization wants the Sudan government to look for alternative forms of power for generating electricity in the country.
We are not actually against development, but there are other options. If we are going to lose these archaeological sites, which can actually make revenue from tourism, why do we build dams and destroy these artifacts and archaeological sites? There are alternatives for making or getting power from solar energy.
He says Sudan and Saudi Arabia signed an agreement to finance the three dams along the Nile in Sudan. He says the Saudi involvement is facilitating the construction of the dams.
Saudi Arabia has offered actually $1.7 billion to build these dams, the dams of Dal, Kajbar, and Ashrek, three dams, which will actually submerge the remaining part of Nubia, and all Nubian treasures will be submerged and destroyed forever.
Jamal Mali Khureshi is the deputy chief of mission at the Sudanese embassy in Washington. Malik says the government conducted extensive studies of the areas before embarking on the construction of dams, and says his government is confident it will not be destroying any historical sites.
With regard to the dams in the north, I would like to reiterate that the government, before going to any idea of building a dam, to see what is the best way to get more power, for the whole country. The dams projects generally in the whole country, in the world, considered to be national projects.
The Kajbar Dam on the Nile Stad Cataract would create a reservoir of 110 square kilometers and generate hydroelectric power with a capacity of 360 megawatts. The Nubian project say the dams would submerge some 90 villages, displace about 10,000 people, and destroy an estimated 500 archaeological sites. The Kajbar and Dal projects are located in the lands of the ancient Nubia. The people living in the area are strongly opposed to the construction of the Kajbar and Dal dams and have warned that the projects could lead to a deadly conflict. The Sudanese government has cracked down harshly on protests who oppose the project. In 2007, security forces killed four people and injured at least 20 others who protested peacefully against the proposed Kajbar dam. The UN Special Rapporteur on Sudan deplored the excessive force used against the Nubian population. VOA fellow Nadia Taha in Washington compiled this report. Now we move to Uganda, where police say they are ready for tomorrow's inauguration of President Yoweri Museveni, who, according to the Electoral Commission, won the February 18 election. But opposition presidential candidate Kizza Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change has insisted he won the vote with a 52% majority. Dr. Besigye has kicked off a campaign of defiance aimed at invalidating what he calls Mr. Museveni's illegal presidency. Yesterday, police searched the offices of the FDC in Kampala, saying they seized illegal propaganda. Police also arrested opposition activists who say they are planning to disrupt the inauguration. Inspector General of Police Kaile Kahura tells VOA's James Batty that security agents will use all means necessary to crush opposition groups planning to disrupt President Museveni's inauguration.
The situation has continued to be very tense, and more of the opposition leaders have been picked up and detained in places that are not known. Others, their homes have been surrounded, and they cannot go out or receive people. At our home, as far as I understand from the people inside the home, it is very, very heavily surrounded, and access into and out is very limited. There's tension in the city everywhere. There are soldiers walking up and down, marching everywhere. So there is very, very high tension. Meanwhile, the Forum for Democratic Change has made a press release announcing that Kizza Besigye has announced a transitional government of national unity and intends to swear this in tomorrow, and says that the transitional government intends to rescue Uganda from a regime that stole the election.
As you know, your house, as you mentioned, is surrounded by Ugandan police and perhaps military security people. Have you spoken to your husband, Dr. Kizza Besigye?
Yes, I have. I didn't know about this press release. We were talking about more ordinary things.
We did speak with the Inspector General of Police, General Kayihura, and he mentioned about the police around your husband's house or in the vicinity of the area, because he says that your husband, Dr. Kizza Besigye, was in violation of Ugandan law by this campaign of defiance that he is involved in.
That is a lie. That is disgracefully untruthful. My husband has not broken any law, and if he had, by now they would have charged him and tried him. He's been under this illegal detention since before the elections. They've had enough time to prosecute him if he was doing anything that is against the law. So, as usual, he's being shameless and lying.
The police said they raided, or they went to the FDC headquarters and found some what they call illegal propaganda materials.
It is true that the office of the opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, was raided yet again. It's been raided many times since before the elections and after. And as usual, they picked up some technology, a printer, and I don't know, some documents. They say the documents are illegal. Then we need to know what is illegal about whatever documents that they took from the office.
That's the member of the opposition FDC speaking to VOA's James Bati today from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. And that's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Pese Kule Club by Kofi Olomide.
El Pirlo Mourinho, Diana St. James Ross. Chuma, 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 kita, anani, kita, kita, chuma, chuma.
I must say I was tempted to dance, but it's not allowed in this studio. We've been listening to Kofi Olomide with the song Pese Kule Club. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.